You're listening to episode 20 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Cheng.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Cheng, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
Hey guys, before we get into today's interview, I'd love to thank Scrivener for sponsoring today's episode. I fell head over heels in love with the writing software ever since I learned about how Scrivener helped my recent guest on the show, award-winning writer Jan Ellison, with her debut novel, A Small Indiscretion. You can check it out for yourself and try Scrivener for free for 30 days. If you end up loving it as much as I do, Scrivener hooked us up with a special 20% off coupon code just for our storyteller tribe, and we have until the end of December 2015 before it expires. Head over to 88cupsofteacom/Scrivener for the coupon code. Hey, storytellers! For last week's episode, I was editing and recording clips in Quebec, Canada. I'm back in LA right now and will be heading off to San Francisco to support one of my best friends, Amy, running in Nike's half marathon this weekend. She's been training so diligently for this big run, and I'm super excited and so proud to see her cross that finish line. And as if timing couldn't have been perfect enough, Amy is the one who actually introduced me to today's guest and suggested that I invite him on the show. I am so excited to share today's episode with you. We have our very first poet on the show, Tyler Knott Gregson. He's one of the most down-to-earth, grounded human beings that I've had the honor of chatting with. We get into the philosophy of life, surviving and thriving as an artist, and expressing our authenticity. We also had a fascinating discussion about social media and how it played a huge role in Tyler's success as a poet and author. Before we jump right in, we'll be doing a special giveaway for Tyler's newest book, All the Words Are Yours, Haiku on Love, which we'll be releasing on October 20th. All you have to do is tweet or post an image of your favorite quote from today's episode. Anything that Tyler says that resonates with you, that's the perfect quote to share. Whether you're posting it on your Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook account, be sure to include the hashtag 88CupsTKG so we can find you. And we'll be giving copies of Tyler's newest book to three lucky listeners. Make sure to post your favorite quote from this episode by Tuesday, October 20th at 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, and that's 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Alrighty, now let's get right into today's episode featuring the one and only Tyler Knott Gregson.
Hey guys, oh my gosh, we have Tyler Knott Gregson with us here today. He is the poet and author of Chasers of the Light, a collection of his typewriter series of his poems. Very beautiful, very moving, and very touching. I actually heard about it through one of my best friends who purchased his book and told me, hey, you've got to check this out. Think about him, reach out to him, and see how it goes. So Tyler, thank you so much for being here with us today. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
We are so pumped to have you with us. So let's get started with some questions. And I'd love to know how you fell in love with writing and specifically with poetry.
Oh, man. I think my love for writing came at a pretty young age. I was always the kid in school that didn't want to be in school. And I loved learning, but I didn't like the rules that came with the way you're supposed to learn when you're in a classroom setting. And so for me, I found that writing really early on was a way for me to kind of get lost during the class without getting into more trouble than I already got into. And so I would just have a piece of paper and a pen, and I kind of just got lost in letting anything I was feeling and thinking kind of pour out onto the page without really thinking much about what structure it fit into, or, you know, I didn't like the rules associated with the way that writing had been taught. And so I think that's why I naturally gravitated towards poetry, because I loved that you could say what you needed to say and you could empty out all of the thoughts in your brain, and you didn't have to have it fit neatly, you know, between five paragraphs, or there didn't have to be a thesis statement and there didn't have to be bibliography at the end of it. It was something that you could do to say all of the things that you sometimes can't say verbally. I think I started writing poetry on my own when I was probably 11 or 12.
Oh, wow.
Outside of class. You know, when you're in elementary school and they have poetry units and you learn how to write limericks and, you know, that kind of stuff. But on my own, I think probably 12 was when I started it. And I just fell in love. I fell in love with the fact that you could say something very complex in a very simple way or vice versa. I love that freedom to just say anything you needed to say, you know, and it sounds really cheesy to say it, but I loved the idea of trying to make words dance together in ways that maybe other people hadn't thought of, or maybe even you didn't know you were capable of.
And from then, when you were about 11, 12 years old, did you find, after falling in love with poetry specifically, did you find that you were writing on a consistent basis all the way through till now, or were there moments where you took a break?
Definitely. I have literally been writing since 11.
Wow.
And I never really slowed down. It was always, you know, I would write little songs or I would write poems. For a time, even I made money doing freelance writing for companies, and I would do copywriting for companies. And I mean, there would be days I would wake up and my first task of the day was to write 500 words about the last golf tournament that took place. And then my next assignment was I had to write about fitness equipment. And then the next was medical imaging software for hospitals. And
oh, wow.
So every day I woke up, I was having to write in a convincing voice about things that either I never knew anything about before or I didn't really care about. And I think that was a really good exercise for me, because in a weird way, in order to write convincingly, you kind of have to fall in love with each different thing that you write about. So that showed me that there is a big, broad world out there with a lot of different interests and a lot of different moving parts. And it's kind of fun trying to write in a fun or beautiful or eloquent or, like I said, convincing way about any of them.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. I didn't know that you did copywriting as well. Was that something that you were doing on the side just to bring in money while you were writing?
I've always had somewhat of an issue with authority. And so,
yeah, I'm actually in the same boat.
Exactly. And so, it was funny. Last weekend or 2 weekends ago, I was actually speaking with a friend and I told him that the last time I legitimately had a boss, someone that you had to check into and swipe the time card, was when I was 15 years old and I worked at a golf shop in my hometown. And that was the last time that I had a boss. And I hated it so much having a boss that I remember telling myself at that point in my life, whatever it takes to have to avoid the real life, I'm going to do it. So literally from 15 until now, it's just been this evolving process of trying to avoid having to take a real job with normal hours, stamp in a time card. And so for a time I did freelance copywriting, and I would do that with freelance photography. And it was just anything I could do to stay in a creative field and be my own boss and set my own hours and kind of have that freedom to decide what jobs you take, what jobs you don't. And literally it's been this musical chairs of trying to figure out how to make money without doing it in a traditional manner.
I admire you for that, by the way.
Oh,
I think that
you
deeply resonates with me as an artist as well, coming from an acting background and then segueing into more writing. I'm also very against authority, and I totally
yes.
get it. It's like we were talking a little bit about this before this interview started, where you are a pioneer. You're one of the pioneers in showing this young generation that, wow, you can go after something that you love to do and you'll survive. It's like
Definitely.
Kind of going against our parents' generation saying you're
it
not
is.
Going to be able to have enough money for food on the table. But it's like, well, no, if we figure out in a smart way, we can survive and we can make a healthy living too, to be comfortable and happy.
Exactly. Yeah. You can do more than survive. You can actually thrive in a creative field. And that's very counter to what, like you said, what we were taught growing up, because it was a joke running when we were growing up that the two things you never wanted to go into in college if you wanted to make money were poetry or
mm-hmm.
writing or philosophy. Those are the two things that
yeah.
they were the dead end streets, you know? And it's, I went to college and I didn't get, my degree wasn't in writing at all. I've never even taken an actual dedicated writing course. And now I look back on it and I have not touched the degrees that I got in college, and everything I'm doing is in the creative field. And all of those bad words, even in the publishing world, you know, poetry is a curse world. And still, I was able to do it, and other people are able to do it. You know what I mean? All of the rules that we were taught growing up don't really apply anymore.
Yeah, that's why I find you so fascinating. You basically broke all barriers in what people thought, you know, what they assume the stereotype of poets. And that's the thing that just blows my mind. And I will definitely dive into this more. But before we get there, because I definitely have a lot of questions to ask you. I'm so curious about, you know, social media and how that really, I feel like social media really helped you to get your work out there.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like in an independent way, which is so honestly badass. And it's so awesome. Yeah. But before we get into that, I'd love to know what inspired you to put together your book.
It's funny because you just mentioned how social media has paved the way for me. And honestly, I would say it is the reason why there's a book on shelves right now. It's the number, I mean, it's the reason. And like I said, I've been writing since I was about 11 or 12, and it was a safety thing for me and a pressure relief thing for me. I wrote because if I didn't do it, I kind of felt like I would go crazy. Mm-hmm. And I never really expected anybody to read it. I don't know if anybody knows this, but I don't even really read the things I write. I have this rule with myself that when I write it, after I'm done writing it and it's pulled out of the typewriter, or it's, you know, if I'm traveling and I have to do it on my phone or my computer, the moment that the last line is typed, it's done. And I have a rule that I'm extremely strict with, that I will not go back and edit a single line or word in the poem. However it came out when I wrote it is how it has to stay, because poetry for me, I don't really think of it as an art that I want. I don't know how to word this, to improve upon or practice. Mm-hmm. For me, it's always just been, like I said, a pressure release, where if I push this thing out and I pour out the things that are inside me, I feel better. I can close that chapter and that's it. And so each poem for me represents an exact moment in time, how I was feeling at that exact moment. So it's almost more of a diary entry for me than it is a curated piece of art. You know what I mean?
Yeah, very therapeutic.
It is. And so, like I said, I never really expected anybody to read it. And I started Tumblr whenever Tumblr started. And that's where I started posting some of the stuff. But I'd been writing and blogging for a long time, I think since about 2003, Whoa. Just on my own little, just on my own personal site. And it was literally just for me to do it and for family and friends if they wanted to randomly check in and see what I was up to or how I was feeling. It was a way for them to keep tabs on me without having to check in all the time. And when I started, there was probably 7 or 8 people that read the things I wrote, and they were all family and friends. And when Tumblr started, I started posting it there. And again, for the first year, I think I probably had 100 followers maybe. And I never expected anybody to read, but I just kept writing because it was that pressure release. And slowly more and more people started finding it and liking it and reblogging it and sharing it and tweeting it. And then when Instagram started up, I had a lot of people telling me that they wished they could read the poetry on there, because it was such an easier way of doing it. You didn't have to go to a website and scroll. You could just see it on Instagram and that would be the end of it. And it was once I started posting those typewriter poems on Instagram that the followers started increasing and spreading. And I think the word kind of got out, and it was literally a grassroots. I didn't do any marketing. I didn't have any help. Nothing. It was just people started liking it and sharing it. And it was the snowball effect. And it just kept rolling and rolling and rolling. And it caused enough of a stir that one winter, my mom suggested, she said, why don't you just try selling some prints of these? Because a lot of people would like to give them as gifts. And I was naive. And I just said, I don't think anybody would even want that. You know, why would people want that? And she said to try it. And enough people bought it that I think the publishing world caught wind of it. And they were the reason that this book came out. They came to me and an agent, and then we did a proposal, and Penguin loved it. And I guess the rest is kind of history, because again, though, even when we started, I don't think anybody even at Penguin expected anybody to buy the book, because it was such a small market and poetry for years and years and years. Unless you're someone monumentally famous, poetry's a really hard thing to sell. So I think it was a shock to everybody when this little book that we made came out and people actually bought it and enjoyed it. And so I was shocked just as much, because like I said, a lot of those poems in there, I haven't read since I wrote them.
I think that's such a huge compliment to you, and just showing like the power of true fans, true supporters.
Exactly.
And I love that you said that you started off grassroots. When you gain these real supporters, basically you built an authentic community of people mm-hmm. who appreciate your work. They'll go with you anywhere. And I think that's so hard nowadays, especially with people like, what was that? The whole crackdown on, what was it? Instagram? What was it? Twitter deleted all
the... Instagram.
Sorry, Instagram deleted all the fake followers.
The paid followers.
Yeah,
yes.
I'm like, oh my gosh, because I'm not exactly the most savvy on social media, but I couldn't believe it got to a point where people were paying for numbers. It's so difficult to grow such a large following of true fans. And that really says a lot about you and your work.
Well, they mean the world to me. Every single person who reads, there's a really wonderful loyalty that I have seen that comes. And I think you hit the nail on the head. When it is grassroots, and when, you know, my favorite thing is when people email me and they say, oh, I remember when you posted your very first poem on Instagram.
Oh, wow.
I've been following you for 4 years or whatever. That means so much to me. And it's funny how loyal they are, because I have sometimes where people will write me emails and they say, people on Etsy are selling prints of your poems. Don't worry, I reported them and they took it down.
Oh, wow.
They do it all on their own. And there's this funny loyalty that comes. I attribute all of it just to honesty. I think that when people read the things I write, they're not always happy, because some days I'm sad, some days I'm great. So everyone has those ups and downs. And it's such a testament to the kind of loyalty that can come when things start in a real way. And when it is grassroots, when you can tell that someone didn't spend $20,000 to get their book on the bestsellers list, which happens all the time. And it breaks my heart. There are companies out there that you can pay them 25 grand and they will buy $25,000 worth of your own book with your
ridiculous
money, you know. And I think people eventually see right through that, and it might work temporarily, but eventually it's going to all fall apart. Just like when the Instagram thing happened, you know, people lost millions of followers in 20 minutes. And for me, I would just rather have transparency and feel like I'm friends with all of the people that pay attention to what I'm doing.
Yeah. And I love that you mentioned the word transparency as well. I really feel like a big reason of why you have so many supportive followers and such a beautiful community is because you are so honest and that you don't backtrack or edit what you write.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, you just write what you feel that day, even if that means you're feeling sad.
Exactly.
Or kind of shitty. You know,
yeah.
It's not. That's the thing. It's like a lot of people put out work where they don't write for themselves anymore. They write for what they think the market wants. And I think that's also an issue with the filmmaking society, where people write things that they think will sell blockbusters.
Yep.
But a lot of times from audiences like me, I love the independent film world. And I feel like that's similar to your followers, where it's like, we want real stuff.
Definitely.
You want substance. I love that choice that you made of not wanting to edit. Like you said, it's like just letting out that emotion, that small therapeutic session.
Yes.
Where everyone can relate to, not to be so dramatic, but at your deathbed, you'll be so proud with your work, where you know that you stuck true to you and your feelings and you respected and honored that. You're like creating this pathway for the young writers to stick true to how they're truly feeling as well and own their feelings and not be ashamed of it.
That means a lot to me. Thank you. It's funny because I get asked a lot in interviews and, you know, when I'm at signings and stuff, I get asked all the time if it bothers me how many people now do their own versions of the typewriter poems, you know, on old scraps of paper, and they post them on Instagram. And what's funny is that never bothers me. If anything, I'm really excited that people are writing again. I love that people are writing again.
Yeah.
But the only time I will say that it bothers me is like when you spoke of something that is so true, and it's something I see all the time that does bother me. It's when people don't write for themselves anymore and they write exactly what they know will get a lot of likes or a lot of people will comment on it. And I think about it and I look at the things that I post each day. And like you just said, I am proud of one thing. And that's that, I mean, if we're honest, if I wanted every single day to have 10,000 people like it and 700 comments, if I was smart, every single day I would write one that is a little bit more sexual, because the trend is when I write one like that, it tends to blow up a little bit more than the other ones. But if you go and you read the things I write, I mean, God, some days I write about like seeing a bird land on my railing, or I have one that I'm about to post, I think tomorrow or something, about the other night when I was standing outside on my deck and three deer came down to my fence and it, you know, it was the blue hour and it was beautiful. And people don't care about those. You know what I mean? Those don't cause the stir that the ones that are about sex or love or longing or whatever, they never do. But it's how I was feeling at that exact moment. And that's what inspired that poem. And so that's the only time I get a little bit bummed out or sad, is when I see people writing the exact same thing over and over and over again, just saying it in different words, just because they know it's going to get popular. That's the only time that I'm like, oh, come on, just find your voice and stick with it. You know, don't be afraid to run straight forward and be honest and be transparent. And if you're hurting, hurt. If you're happy, be happy. You don't have to fit into this mold that seems to be getting popular.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad there's someone like you out there that's trying to break that whole cycle. And that relates to like most kids who have Instagram and Twitter nowadays. I love people who post images, for example, now talking a little bit about Instagram, like things that they see on their day-to-day life.
Sure.
I love that. Okay, even if that means posting what you're eating three times a day, I do care because I love food.
Exactly.
You know, like,
yeah.
So what? There's so many people who like to post half-naked photos because they know it'll get them likes. Very similar to your world where people are writing more about sexual things. It's like, oh, come on. Like, don't sell yourself so short, you know?
There's more.
Where are those people who magnify the little things? Like what you said, you saw three deer when you're standing out by your porch the other day. You're magnifying the little moments in life. You're adding sprinkles of magic into the mundane.
The little moments for me have always been the big moments. And I don't know, I always get really lost in very simple gestures and very simple expressions. To me, I always have thought that the little things tell the bigger stories. And the other half of my job is I'm a photographer and I travel all over the world shooting weddings. And that's the most common thing that we ever photograph is just weddings. And the thing that I've found is it's very easy to take epic wedding photos that are super grand and have an amazing background and you're in a beautiful location and you can do that. And that tells part of the story at that wedding. And, you know, and it's something that they will all want to hang up on their wall. But what I found is my favorite part of every wedding, I think the challenge of every wedding is to find those tiny little moments that go unnoticed, but that really do tell a much bigger story. Like I can tell when I meet a couple immediately what is really behind their story or the story that they tell of how they met or what they believed. I can tell based on all of those little things. And to me, it is those little tiny things that are everything. And I wish that those moments were given more merit. And I think that's what I've always tried to do both with my photography and with my writing is highlight those tiny little things. And I remember there was one line I wrote and it stuck with me. And it was the most simple 4 seconds of someone's life. And it was just about a woman trying to keep the strap of her dress on top of her shoulder blade, even though it keeps falling down. And that's a moment that if you blink, you're going to miss it of somebody, whether it's your girlfriend or your wife or your best friend or whatever it is. Most people miss that moment or they don't think about it twice. And the last line of that song or that poem was the delicacy of an uncelebrated moment. And I think those moments, the uncelebrated ones, are everything to me. And they're honestly, they're why I keep writing. And people ask why, you know, how have you not had writer's block yet? You've written, you know, almost 1,200 poems. How have you not had writer's block? That's why, because there are a billion uncelebrated moments that if you look hard enough, you're always inspired. Always. You are absolutely always inspired if you just look hard enough. And yeah, so that's what I always try to do in any art that I do is to try to find those uncelebrated moments.
Yeah, and without intending to, it sounds like you're creating this new perspective, like a new wave of appreciating what you have right now. That's a huge issue, especially with the younger generation, because I have 2 younger sisters. When I hear about how their friends are talking about certain things,
sure.
And it's like, wow, they keep wanting more and more and more. Not just
exactly.
The younger generation is guilty of it. We all are. I know I'm guilty of it as well. But it's because of works like yours where we kind of take a moment and we stop and we appreciate, you know, like a meditation where they're like, calm down, keep quiet, and just
focus
on your breath. Like, who in their right mind is going to be focusing on the breath when they're rushing every single day, you know, doing what they need to do? It's little moments like that. And you're helping with that movement of creating appreciation in the daily life and being happy with what you have and not stop being so greedy of wanting more and more and more and more. You know, and I think that's dangerous. That's when you're cultivating unhappiness for the rest of your life.
Well, and everything is so impermanent now more than ever. And, you know, I've been following Buddhism for a long time, since I was 12, actually. And one of the core teachings is just of impermanence. And that, you know, the very first noble truth in Buddhism is that life is suffering. And most people hear that and they think, oh, well, Buddhism is negative. You know, it says that all life is suffering, but it's a completely different feeling than that. And that's a different truth. And the root of all of that is impermanence. Nothing ever lasts. But the problem that I have seen is in our society, we almost praise things that don't last, you know, and media and mass media, it's always the next big thing. And everything is focused on the next big thing. And it might last 10 minutes and then the next day it's gone. And we've become accustomed to that. And like you were saying with films, I love independent films because they're edited differently, mm-hmm. you know, and you compare it to a blockbuster, which I love watching blockbusters too. I mean, don't get me wrong. I will, you know, I love watching movies like The Avengers and stuff like that.
Okay, I do feel guilty because I do like big blockbuster movies like The Avengers. I literally was just thinking that.
That's awesome. They're so fun. Yeah. But if you notice, if you were to compare and hold them up, like if you were to say a movie like Lost in Translation versus The Avengers, The Avengers is quick cuts, fast edits. Mm-hmm. You're never looking at one thing longer than maybe 3 seconds. It's very rare that these long takes are filmed. And the movies that I love and that I emotionally relate to the most are the ones that pay attention to the light, or they pay attention to how long a take is. I mean, I think of, you know, the movie Children of Men, and there's like a 7.5 minute action scene in that movie where the camera never cuts. And that attention to artistry and detail for me brings me in so much more because it's not flash in the pan and it's not quick edit. And going back to those uncelebrated moments, for me in Lost in Translation, for example, the most profound moment in that entire film of intimacy, the most perfect expression of intimacy, is when they're laying on that bed together, fully clothed, and he reaches down and he touches her foot. And for me, when I see that, that's what I feel about the way I like to write and the things I like to write about. Rather than laying about two people laying in a bed, I'm more interested and more emotionally resonated by that simple gesture of when he puts his hand on her foot. You know what I mean? And I love that. And if it's beyond flattering for you to say that I'm helping new generations or new people kind of see the world that way, that's mind-blowing to me that I would have anything to do with it. It's funny because it's just the way I've always seen things. And it's been very inspiring to see and hear from people that in any way possible, if they're seeing things in a new way or a way that makes them happier, that is a completely unintended consequence that I'm very, very, very happy about. And it makes me feel really lucky to kind of be in a position where that is even possible.
You are so humble. It's ridiculous. but I want to touch on the Buddhism because I was raised as a Buddhist. My family's Buddhist. And actually one of my best friends, Amy, she actually was like, oh, by the way, he's Buddhist. You know, the one who introduced me to your work. And that actually slipped my mind during this interview until you brought it up. And I was like, oh, yeah, he is Buddhist.
Then
I do, number one, I want to know how you got into Buddhism. And number two, now I see it. It's all like connected. No wonder you appreciate the uncelebrated moments. You take time to, again, like focus on the breathing, on the breath, you know? And sorry if I'm jumping to assumptions, but a big part of Buddhism played a role in that, in the way you see the world, in the way you see things, and in your writings, it kind of comes through.
1,000%, yes.
Yeah, I'm like, now I'm seeing it. I'm like, oh my gosh. Tell me a little bit about how you got into Buddhism at 12 years old, because I'm sure your parents didn't raise you as a Buddhist.
No, they did not. And I live in Montana. First of all, there aren't very many Buddhists. And second of all, there aren't very many men who write poetry. So I was always kind of an oddball. But my dad is in professional baseball, and he has been my entire life. And so we grew up very nomadic, and we traveled all the time. You know, usually about half of the year would be spent in Montana, where my mom's family is. And then the other half would be my whole family traveling with my dad, because where his baseball team would be. So my mom would pack us up and we would all go meet him where his team was. And then we would spend the other half of the year there. And because of that, he traveled a lot. And he went to Saudi Arabia when I think it was 12. And he had to do a baseball clinic in Saudi Arabia. And he was staying in the hotel and he knew how much I loved to read. And I think my family's always known that I was kind of an oddball child. You know, I didn't always loved the things that everybody else loved. And I never fell into trends and I never had different haircuts or I never cared about different styles of clothes. I was always just kind of a weird kid. And so he was in the hotel and there were two books in there. Three books. There was a Bible, a Quran, and this little tiny black book that was called The Teaching of Buddha. And my dad at that point had never researched Buddhism, didn't know anything about it, but he looked at the book and he just thought, I bet Tyler would like this book. And so he grabbed it and he brought it home and he gave it to me. And I started reading it and it felt like coming home. It just made sense. And at that point, I had been raised Presbyterian. My dad's from the South. And so I lived in the South until I was about 5. And so we were raised Presbyterian. And I just never quite connected with the teachings and the ideas and the, again, probably the rules. I never connected with it. And he handed me this book called The Teachings of Buddha, and immediately I fell in love. And it lined up so precisely with how I have, at that point, how I had been seeing the world. And then more than that, how I had always wanted to see the world. Mm-hmm. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And that started me right then and right there. That started my kind of slow meandering journey through Buddhism. And I'm still learning and I struggle. I'm sure like you probably do too. I struggle with certain things. Yeah, it's hard. You know, especially in the world we live in today. It is really hard to always be mindful in a culture that doesn't prize it. But I just loved it. And it planted in me this kind of this seed of reverence for every single thing around me. And I get asked it a lot, even by my friends, and I don't know how to answer it, but I always kind of see everything as a miracle and as just like this wonder to behold. And I don't know why that is, but it definitely, it leaks out in the things I write about, because like I said, it's why I'm always inspired, because there are a billion little miracles everywhere and I love finding them. And I love when other people find them too. It makes me very, very happy. So
that's amazing. Thank you for sharing that. Because I know usually the topic of religion is usually quite sensitive for interviews, but sure. I couldn't help but to ask. So
no.
I appreciate you being so open.
I don't even really consider Buddhism a religion very much.
It's more of like a way of thinking.
It is. Yeah. I remember they asked the Dalai Lama once, they asked him what his religion was, and he answered that his religion was kindness.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I love that. I love that it doesn't require rigid dogma and it doesn't seclude either. I love that. I love that it's so open. And, you know, it's why the fourth side of the Tibetan flag isn't painted yellow. Yellow is the color of Buddhism, but they left one side open to be open to all other religions and all other cultures. And I love that. I think that kind of speaks to what Buddhism
exactly
is.
Exactly. It signifies exactly what Buddhism is. It's funny because I brought home someone in the past, and I remember my aunt, who's a Buddhist nun. She said, listen, make sure you always support this friend, because I know this friend is Catholic. Make sure you always tell them and encourage them to go to church if that's what makes them happy. And I was like, blown away. And my and my mom's mom, she left the family to be a Buddhist nun. And
it was
a serious thing. But she couldn't really see the kids after, like, well, they were more grown up. You mentioned a little bit about impermanence, detachment in a way, where it's like true enlightenment, you know, studying Buddhism.
Sure.
You can't have any attachments to certain things. It's so interesting with your writings. When I read it, I feel very attached to that moment, but then it's observing from a detached point of view, if that even makes sense at all.
Oh, it does. It absolutely does.
And it kind of reminded me of my grandma leaving, where she's doing something for the better, for good, but then has to do it from a detached way, from a detached perspective, in order to give all of herself.
For
and
sure.
It's like really full circle. It's really kind of cool. And I'm having goosebumps right now. But yeah, but thank you again for opening up about that. And I think that's so cool. Let's get back a little bit more into the writing part. And I know you say you find inspiration everywhere, yeah? Your writings in the book, there's different mediums that you write on. I know that you said you started writing when you were 11 or 12. I'm assuming you started writing more on like regular lined paper, I'm guessing?
I did, yeah.
Okay.
So going through school, we found out later, because when I was growing up, I feel old, but I'm not old, but I feel old. But when I was growing up, there wasn't a great deal of attention paid to current problems that a lot of kids are facing. And one of those was, we've since found out that I have Asperger's, and I'm very high functioning and stuff, but going through school with that, I never had a notebook. I never had a pencil. I didn't bring textbooks to class. I didn't have any of those things because I just couldn't handle it. And so I remember 99% of the things I wrote going through school would be on borrowed paper that friends loaned me, or that I tore out of a newspaper or something that I found. And I would write my little poems on those little pieces of scraps that I could bum off of my friends that were sitting around me. It's kind of funny looking at the mediums that my poems are presented on now. I think it's just the natural evolution of that. And now when I travel so much, random scraps find their way into my life a lot more often. And so I always just thought, what better than recycle them and put the poems on there? Because it's a lot easier for me. And visually, it means a lot more to me than just putting it on white paper, because I think it calls back again the diary nature of the poetry that I write. You know, it's fun for me to see a poem written on a receipt from the Los Angeles airport or a restaurant in Tarrytown, New York. Or do you know what I mean? It's fun to see for me. Oh, I remember feeling that on that day, and I wrote it on, you know, a piece of paper that came from that day. And so, yeah, I think it was just a natural evolution for me of never having actual paper.
Gotcha. I love that. I was actually wondering, because I know there was one specific poem in your book, the one on the airplane boarding ticket. To me, It came off like you found this boarding ticket that you had in your bag or something. Yep. And then from there, from the wordings that you wrote, I thought that you perhaps saw it, and then it gave you inspiration for a traveling inspired poem.
Definitely. That happens all the time.
Okay. Sounds more like it just comes at any random moment.
It does. And that's kind of how my whole inspiration process is too. I always keep an open notepad thing on my phone just in case. It always comes, like all my poetry seems to come from one line. Usually the entire poem is born above and below just one line. That's it. Same thing with the paper. There's not a great deal of forethought into it. Sometimes, yes, like, you know, with that traveling one, seeing that boarding pass, I'm sure sparked a memory that then made me want to write a poem about that. But a lot of the times it's just completely random, because again, writing for me is just that cathartic thing. It's just the spilling out and pouring out of anything that's going on in my head at the time. And so you never know when you're going to reach that, like that boiling over point where you just have to get it out. And so the paper and the poetry kind of are married together in that same way, where it's very, very random and it just happens when it happens. And there's not a great deal of planning or anything. It's very spontaneous.
I know we already talked a bit about how difficult it is to kind of make a living if you're first starting off in the creative world, like especially being a writer, if they hate having a boss as well and hate authority as much as we do. What would you advise they do in order to basically put a roof over their head, have some money, not to the point where they need to be spending left and right, but just enough for like rent and food, where they can feel like, all right, it's doable. It's not as scary. I can still do what I love and make money.
That's a tough one. Honestly, I never expected to make a penny from what I've been doing. And so it's been surprising that, like I said, anybody even cared enough to help me make any money at all on this. But for me, I think the thing that made me have to succeed was that I just drew a line in my mind, and it was one that I refused to cross. And I was so committed to the fact that I wanted to not follow a traditional path, that I didn't give myself any option. It was either you're going to succeed or you're going to fail absolutely miserably. And my mom loves to tell this, that, you know, she loves to say to people, when people ask, well, how did Tyler get his start? How did he get a book? That's crazy. And my mom always says, I knew from the very beginning that Tyler was either going to be just fine and be successful, or he was going to be a miserable failure and he was going to end up living in our basement. You know what I mean? And I love that. I appreciate that, because I wasn't willing to settle for that muddy gray area in between that I feel like a lot of people get comfortable there and settle there because it's safe. And I was never willing to settle in there where it's safe. And there were a lot of years where, God, I remember living in Washington for a while, and I just started doing some freelance writing, and I was making like $186 a month. That's all I was making. And my little sister was like living with me in an apartment so we could make rent each month. Still, I refused to back down from that pursuit, because I knew if I gave in, I would always look back and say, I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have given in. And so I guess it might be horrible advice. And there's probably, you know, parents of kids who are 18 who are going to be like, shut him up. But if you're serious and if you know what you love, don't ever, ever stop fighting for that thing that you love, whatever it is, whether it's filmmaking or writing or singing or whatever artistic pursuit. The world always is going to need doctors, and it's always going to need lawyers, and it's always going to need teachers. But like, I mean, it sounds just like Dead Poet Society, but it's true. Without the artistics and without the creatives, the world is just a lot more empty. And if it's something that's calling you, I think you just have to draw that line in the sand in your brain and just say, I'm unwilling to cross back over this. And I believe that when you throw yourself headfirst into something like that, and it might be naive, but I believe that the universe is going to try to conspire to help it. And I look around and it's abundantly true. A lot of chance things have happened that I can't explain that have happened to let me be where I am today. And I honestly believe it's because I refused to settle. And I think that's really the mantra that I think you always have to go, whether it's with a job or with love. It's so, so easy to settle and just say, all right, that's good enough. This is okay. This will do. And that's a deadly, deadly trap.
It's very true. Thank you for sharing that. And I know what you were saying. It's like, yeah, some parents, the ones who like sugarcoating, you know, they may not be thrilled, but you know what? This is reality. If we don't tell them, it hurts them.
It does.
Because guess what? At the end of the day, when they're much older, they're going to regret listening to the parents who wanted to sugarcoat everything.
Exactly.
And to tell them to live a safe, comfortable life. They're going to think in the end, like, wow, 60 years of my life just went by for what?
Sure.
You know, and it's just this falsehood.
It is. And, you know, when we die, the only thing that we really look back on with any form of regret are just all of the little risks that we just let pass us by because we were too scared. And what's the point? What is the point of that?
Yep, absolutely. Tyler, I wanted to know a little bit about mentors and if you've ever worked with mentors. It doesn't sound like you did because you sound like you're the kind of person that beats to your own drum and you just do it once your heart is set on something. So am I right in assuming that you did not have a mentor before?
I have not, no. I've always just been really afraid, and I've said this before, but I've always been terrified when it comes to artistic or creative things. I don't ever want anyone to teach me because I am terrified that if I am taught how to do anything artistic or creative, that I'm going to do it like the person that taught me, and then it stops being creative.
Yeah, it's a trap.
It is. I don't ever want to lose that imagination. And that's like with photography. I never wanted to learn the rules about what makes a good photo because then I might miss out on 1,000 technically bad photos that are really beautiful or really emotional. And I think the same thing goes for my writing. I was always very afraid, even to be honest, even to read too much of other people's stuff, especially modern and contemporary people. I try not to because I don't want to be influenced by other people's voices. Because again, poetry for me isn't an art form that I've ever treated as something that needs to be more than it is.
Yeah.
For me, it's a therapeutic release. And yeah, so I always just try to make sure that my voice stays as pure as to me as possible. And so no, mentors, I haven't really. I mean, there's old poets that I absolutely adore, but I've never wanted to write like them because I love Walt Whitman, but I can't relate to the world that Walt Whitman lived in. I can't relate to the struggles that he went through at all. And so why would I try to write like them?
Interesting. That's a really good point. But I get where you're coming from. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Was there a poem that you ever felt very resistant with, like you felt like it was difficult? I know you say you kind of just bang it out and just leave it, but was there ever like one poem that you remember that stands out to you that took a while to get through? Like you, maybe you like wrote halfway and suddenly you're stuck. You're like, oh crap, you know, or like maybe blanked out or something.
Honestly, no. And that probably sounds like people are probably hating me. They all kind of come out in one burst. If I'm being completely honest with you, I think the longest that a poem has ever taken me is the length of the time it takes me to type it.
Really?
Really?
Oh, you're so annoying. Come on.
I know. That's what
I mean. Are you human? Stop.
I always feel horrible answering that question because I read, you know, stuff about Bukowski. He always talked about writing being the struggle and you have to batten down the hatches and get some whiskey and sit down and like really knuckle down and get into the poem. And for me, it has never been that thing. It's literally more of a, I mean, this is going to really piss people off, but there's been times where I've sat down at a computer, for example, and I have a line in my head. And I'll literally look up an hour later and I will have written 13 poems.
Ugh.
And they're all different and they're about different things and they're different lengths and they're different styles and they're some rhyme, some don't. And I don't know where they come from. And I don't know.
Wow. Okay. We get it, Tyler. You're a prodigy. Settle down.
No, that's not even. That's
I'm
not,
kidding.
I don't know. Because here's the truth. And this is the other truth that I don't ever say. I honestly don't know if anything I write is good or bad because usually it just comes out and then that's the end of it. I don't revisit it. The only time I even see it again is when I'm transferring it from computer to typewriter.
Wow.
For every one person that likes what I'm writing, I'm sure there's two that don't. And that's totally fine because for me, the writing has always been a personal escape rather than a public event.
Yeah. Okay. I feel like we're speaking to like the new age version of the Dalai Lama right now. Like, oh, you're so perfect. We get it.
No, that's the
complete no. I'm totally kidding.
Of the truth.
I'm honestly just here, like behind the mic, rolling my eyes and turning green.
I don't know if I could be any further away from perfect if I tried to be.
But well, I'm sure a lot of people disagree, and clearly, because your book is doing so well, tell us a little bit about the book. What was the reception of it? How did people take it?
I was blown away, and I think Penguin was blown away. Literally, I thought it was going to be something that maybe 1,000 people bought.
Yeah.
I think the stat that my agent gave me was 95% of all books don't sell more than 3,000 copies in their lifetime.
What?
And yeah, it was some crazy stat like that. And 97% of all authors don't earn out the advance that they're given or something like that.
I had no idea.
Well, I mean, because there's so many books that come out every day. Not all of them can do well, obviously. And I always thought my book would be one of those books that did maybe 1,000 copies scattered around from people online. I never, ever expected it to do as well as it's doing. And I mean, it's so humbling because on Instagram, people will tag me in things and it'll be someone holding up the book in Dubai or in Africa or in all over the world and Croatia. And it absolutely blows my mind. I got an email today. You mentioned the Dalai Lama, and a girl right now is in Dharamsala, India, where the Dalai Lama lives.
Awesome.
And she said she went to a monastery the day after she got there, and she was walking around the monastery and she saw a monk reading a book. And she walked up and the monk was reading my book. And
get out.
And she went and spoke with him and she said, oh, I'm a fan of his too. And I like that book too. And the guy said that some friend of his, of a friend of a friend, sent it over from New York. And he said now, even like the girl quoted in the book, he said that now he always tries to chase the light. And I like that blows my mind. I can't make that make sense because I live on a mountain in Montana all by myself. And it's like, I don't really get to see the ripple effect of anything very often unless I'm traveling. And so to see that, you can't put a price on how thankful it makes me and how
humbling. Absolutely.
Well, yeah. How crazy it is. It's just crazy.
That's amazing. I'm so happy for you. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And that was honestly you creating that success and appreciation of the arts from other people towards your work because you decided not to hold yourself back and to be truthful and authentic in everything you felt. You see, it all started with that.
It did.
And look at this ripple effect. It's insane. You're pretty good about getting back to people, like on your Instagram.
It still weirds me out. Like it'll happen sometimes where we're traveling somewhere for a wedding and someone will come up and they'll recognize and they'll want a photo or something like that. Whenever that happens, it takes me the 25 or 30 seconds. I always think that I must know them. I'm always like, wait, where did we meet? Where did we know you? I never realize. And then, you know, it always has to be like, oh, it's because of the book or because of Instagram or whatever. It's funny because it embarrasses me. And I'm always like, no, we're just friends. You and I are just friends. Like, you're not a fan. You're just like my friend that I haven't really met yet.
Oh, that's so sweet.
I just don't feel like I look at people who I look up to and who I think should be you should get super excited to meet. And it is. It's people like the Dalai Lama or it's, you know, Nelson Mandela, people who have done these grand things that have helped so many people or elicited such change. And so whenever I see people happy or whatever to say hi to me, it always takes me a while to be like, wait, what's going on? What is happening?
That's so awesome, man. That's so rare. That really is. Like, it's humbling for us to hear how there are still people like you out there who are, you know, you are very successful in what you're doing. That's the truth. But then it's the way you go about it, the way you carry yourself. And it's a very classy way of doing it. And I admire that.
Thank you.
So you're freaking awesome.
Much.
So I'm going to have one more question. One or two books that you love that you can recommend to our listeners that has helped you in your journey, whether it's in your life or as a writer.
Oh, man. I wish you were sitting here right now because I'm really weird. And I have this giant bookshelf on my wall that is, it literally spans like an 18-foot wall. And they're all color-coded. So you'd really think I was crazy.
Are you serious? What, are you OCD?
Well, no, there's this weird, I don't even know what it is. There's this Aboriginal myth that there's like this rainbow-colored snake. And so if you organize your books in that same pattern, then it's supposed to help protect your house. It's ridiculous, but I love it.
Oh, great. Now that I heard it, and I'm a very superstitious person, now I'm going to have to do it and spend like a week doing this right now.
But it's funny.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Well, once you do it, you're going to be shocked at how much you recognize books by their color rather than by their art, like the title or the author. It's funny. Whenever people ask, like, where's that book? I always know what color it is. It's funny.
That's insane.
Gosh, I would say one book that I think is so underrated and that not many people have read. It's called The End of the Alphabet, and it's by C.S. Richardson.
Mm-hmm.
And it is stunningly beautiful with very few words. And the way that those few words are used, it almost feels like you're reading one long haiku almost, because it's so sparse in its language. And it's perfect. It's absolutely perfect the way that it's written. And so the books I love the most are the ones that I said way earlier. I said, I love when words dance together. Something about this book, just it feels like the words are just absolutely waltzing around each other the entire story. And so, yeah, I would say The End of the Alphabet. Jeez. One book I really love is The Book Thief. And it's a young adult book, but I think that some of the writing in that book is gorgeous. And the use of death as a narrator, I think, is super fascinating. And I love the way that that story is written.
Nice.
So, yeah, maybe The Book Thief and The End of the Alphabet.
And what colors are those? Purple and orange, I'm guessing.
No, The End of the Alphabet is like this kind of brownish maroon color. And The Book Thief is black on the cover. So.
Oh, darn. Okay. Well, the maroon orange one, I was a little close, right?
Yeah, you're close. It's like,
so there we go. But the other one, not so much.
Yeah, the other one is all the colors combined.
Okay, there we go.
Technically, orange is in there.
See? There we go. So I am right.
You're all right.
So what's up for you next? Let us know so we know where to look out.
Yeah, I have something to announce. I don't know when they're letting me announce it, but there's some cool news that I'm going to be announcing probably in the next week or two.
Okay.
Big news, so it's fun. And then I also have a children's book coming out in 2016 that I wrote with my best friend Sarah.
Aww. That's so awesome. That's so cool. How long have you known Sarah for?
Oh my gosh. I've known her since we were probably 15, but over the last 6 years, she's my business partner as well. Over the last 6 years, we've been pretty inseparable. But actually, I have like six children's books that I've written, but one of them for sure is being published, and there'll be a lot more news about that. But it'll be the fall of 2016, I believe, for that.
Nice. I'm so excited for you. And congratulations to you and your best friend.
Thank you.
I'm sure that feels amazing to create something with someone that you really care about. So I'm super pumped for you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, and congrats to Sarah, too. And so, Tyler, I'll let you go then.
Perfect. Well, it was an absolute pleasure. Thank you for letting me be a part of this.
Absolutely. Thank you for being our very first poet. So this is pretty badass. And a wedding photographer. So hello. Exactly. That's awesome. Oh, wait, tell us where we can find your wedding photography work.
Oh, sure. It's treehousephotography.org, all one word. And we travel everywhere. We fly. In fact, we only usually have about two weddings in Montana a year. All the other ones are out of state or out of country. And so it's our favorite thing to do. We love traveling and we love being with people on their best days. And so if anybody wants wedding photography, get a hold of us. We would love to meet you.
Amazing. And no bridezillas allowed.
No, well, even the bridezillas. I mean,
okay, you're too nice.
You only get that day once. And so if you need to be a little bossy on that day, we understand.
Oh, how sweet. Awesome. I'm sure the listeners are going to walk away very, very inspired and loving you even more. And if not, even more fans now.
Oh, that's awesome.
So thank you again, Tyler, for your time, truly, and for opening up and being so honest and genuine with your work and with this interview, with the way you live. So I think you are awesome.
Well, the feeling's mutual.
Thank you. I will talk to you soon, okay?
All right, sounds good.
Hey, storytellers, how awesome is this episode? Thank you so much for listening in. I remember our interview left me feeling so zen and elated, and I hope it does the same for you. A huge heartfelt thank you to Tyler for being so freaking awesome, open, and fully present during our chat. Please say hi to Tyler over on Twitter or Instagram at TylerKnott. That's TylerKnott. And you can also find Tyler on Facebook at facebook.com/TylerKnottGregson. To learn more about Tyler, visit his official website at TylerKnott.com. tylernotgregson.com. For links to all of Tyler's book recommendations and movie references, be sure to head over to his show notes page at 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/TylerNotGregson. Don't forget to tweet or post an image of your favorite quote that really resonated with you from Tyler's episode, and we'll be gifting a copy of his newest book, All the Words Are Yours, Haiku on Love, to 3 lucky listeners. Make sure to hashtag 88cupsTKG so we can find your quotes. Deadline for this giveaway is Tuesday, October 20th at 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, and that's 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Good luck! A heartfelt thank you to Scrivener for making this episode possible. I've honestly been having a bit of trouble keeping the ball rolling with a story that I want to write. A lot of times I make excuses to myself not being able to write for the day because I can't seem to find that great idea I jotted down for a chapter or the latest draft of that excerpt I wrote. Having Scrivener helps me a whole lot in getting rid of those excuses for myself. I'm honestly still having a bit of trouble committing fully to writing that story, but Scrivener makes things a lot easier for me when I'm feeling extra brave that day in tackling characters, ideas, and the story structure. I actually learned about Scrivener through one of my recent guests on the show. You may have heard her episode. It's the one featuring award-winning writer Jan Ellison of A Small Indiscretion. I've been using Scrivener for almost everything that involves writing ever since Jan raved about the software. Scrivener has truly helped make my life easier, and I'm excited to share this company with you. If you're a storyteller and haven't tried Scrivener out for yourself yet, you need to download their 30-day free trial. Give it a go, and if you end up loving it as much as I do, Scrivener is hooking us up with a special 20% off coupon code just for our storyteller tribe, and we have until the end of December 2015 before it expires. Head over to 88cupsoftea.com/scrivener for the coupon code.
Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye.